Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that was Exodus by the great Bob Marley, born on this day in 1945.
We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Cheryl LaRoche. She's a lecturer, public speaker, consultant, researcher, professor in the American Studies Department at the University of Maryland College Park. And she's written this book, which is, as I was describing to her a moment ago, part of this new lexicon of books that are coming out that are very powerfully important to understand who we are as a people, talking about how folks, black folks, had their own agency in the struggle for liberation in this country, but seen from a very different perspective, seen from the perspective of an archaeologist, of archaeology. How does that fit in? Well, the book is called Free Black Communities and the Underground Railroad, The Geography of Resistance, which does explore how the free communities assisted in with runaways through these Midwestern communities, several of them. And looking back at what she found here is just amazing. And Dr. Cheryl LaRoche, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
May I call you Cheryl?
Oh, please do.
Okay. This is an important book. I mean, let me take a step back before I talk about its importance and ask you to talk a bit about, I mean, how you came upon this idea. I mean, your PhD is in?
It's in American Studies and Archaeology and African American History.
So how did you come to this particular idea of putting this book together for your thesis, but also the idea about how archaeology plays a critical role, can play a critical role in understanding who we are, that we never think of it that way? Not about this issue anyway.
You know, certainly I'd been looking at the Underground Railroad even before I went to grad school. But when I got to grad school, Dr. Paul Shackle, who's an archaeologist at the University of Maryland, asked me would I go out west and look at three archaeological sites that the National Forest Service was looking at. They wanted a scholar who could really tie together a fairly expansive study. And I was an older returning grad student and had a lot of research capacity behind me and went out west and started to look at these sites. Hmm. The archaeologist already thought they were seeing things, but they couldn't prove it. They needed someone to come in and start to really do the research to support that. And that's what I did over the course of 5 or 6 years, is just do the research.
Where, when you said out west?
I started out in New Philadelphia in Illinois. I went, and then I was sent to Rocky Fork by the community out there, which is also in Illinois. Then I went down to Miller Grove, which is in southern Illinois, north of Paducah, Kentucky, and then went to Polk Patch.
Polk Patch?
I'm a New York girl. Polk Patch.
I love that name.
And,
Polk
in,
Patch.
Indiana, and then went on Lick Creek in Indiana.
So you said out west. It threw me off. You mean like the areas that you really focused on?
Yes.
And these were the border states?
Yes, at the border region. So I was in the southern regions of those states, which is very – the southern regions of northern states are very different in terms of how slavery and freedom is conceived. And so there's a zone that kind of strips through that
area. What do you mean about how slavery is conceived?
Well, I think that southern Indiana, southern Illinois, very pro-South. And
right.
When you get into the northern southern states, they're less virulent. So you have this zone of where slavery is still being enforced less rigorously, I don't want to say less rigorously, but maybe not as virulently in the southern portions of the northern portions of the southern states and the southern portions of the northern states.
Yeah, because it's becoming clear and clear from your book and from other things that have come out recently, slavery also was being horrendous wherever it was, but it wasn't this monolith. Depending on where you were in
Absolutely.
The country, it was acted out in very different ways, partially because of the free black communities that existed in this belt between the North and the South.
It's very different across time and across space, depending on whether it's urban, whether it's rural, whether it's industrial, whether it is technical. There's all different ways in which slavery is conceived. And these black communities, you know, if you start to think of the cabin quarters on plantations as a form of a black community, because when African Americans are coming out of slavery in the South, it's the plantation quarter that are giving them aid and kind of helping them and feeding them. When they get into the North, particularly in the border regions, these free black communities are often their very first stop before they get handed off into any kind of a network.
See, let's talk a bit about this, because in the beginning of the book, you lay this out a lot in the introduction of the book.
Yes.
When this is one part in here where you talk about the newspapers like the Albany Patriot. You know, there's been headlines. We know all about it.
Yes.
And you write about the Zion Church in Lower Manhattan.
Yes.
That had the society called the New York State Vigilance Committee, composed of mostly colored people. This is a quote, instituted expressly for the management of the Underground Railroad. And this whole idea of you write about the black activism that went beyond newspapers and pamphlets and was really deep, and that's what we don't hear about.
Not at all. And if you think about the way history is constructed, because right. You and I were speaking about this, you have people telling what they knew. And this is an organization that had to be secret. These were activities that were against the law in many circumstances. And you have people that are being legislated into not being able to read and write. And so what we've been handed is a very stilted, almost truncated history. And now to do this work took quite a long time to do the research, because you don't have your conventional sources. You don't have access. You don't go into a library and say, show me
right.
the section on free black communities and the Underground Railroad. It doesn't exist.
You're building it.
I'm building it.
You're building
or
it.
Or we're building
right.
it, those of us who are doing this work.
Because you also wrote later on in the book that as an archaeologist,
yes,
that when you dig to find these stories, literally in some ways,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
That the white abolitionist movement and their homes could be more readily found,
yes.
But the black homes had been destroyed, so it also yes. made it much more difficult.
I say this repeatedly wherever I lecture. I am an archaeologist because generally there's nothing left. And for the most part, I mean, there are standing structures, but there's much more resources around African-American history in the ground than there are standing.
What do you mean by that?
Because, you know, we can, you put a parking lot in, which, you know, seems to happen to so many of African American historical resources, once you remove the top layer of that lot or go down, you can start to go into the area of the soil of the earth that has not been impacted by development. Sometimes, of course, backhoe or bulldozer has taken it all out, but there are times when there are traces in the ground, and we can read that from an archaeological perspective. We can figure out where the foundations were. We can look at the trash. We can look at the remnants and really start to piece together a narrative. And I've said this about the Underground Railroad in particular and free black communities, just locating them, just starting to do the surveys, just mapping where they once were is a huge service that archaeology can offer before we ever put a shovel in the ground. And so, you know, those are the ways in which archaeology is very helpful. And then when we move further into it, when we find these sites, as they did out in Miller Grove, for example, and in Polk Patch in Ohio, you can start to then piece together an argument.
And you did piece together that argument. I think that when you talked about that, there are places here in just the Baltimore County area around Pennsylvania that where all black communities lived,
yes,
where the beginnings of struggles took place, real struggles took place,
yes.
Very important ones in history. No one's ever thought about going to those places now where developments might be, where old black communities live still in some small ways, to dig to see what's in that earth.
Yes, and to begin to lay them out. And I think that what I found across the country, because I've traveled probably from New Hampshire to Missouri, and I was out in California talking to folks out there. So I've been across the country thinking about this, and each small area may know their story, but generally speaking, even at the county level, you can't get a coherent county history of what I'm talking about, let alone a statewide history. So what I've been advocating, I don't think I said it directly in the book, is that I want to remap America and bring these black these are pre-Civil War sites, but, you know, this phenomenon goes on beyond the Civil War, and most people think of it as a post-Civil War kind of experience where these black soldiers are coming back from the war and they start these towns. But it's going on for a century before that.
And what I was alluding to a minute ago, and come right back to your book, because it's interesting, the area we're in now led to the Christiana Rebellion.
Yes.
In Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And this, so no one's, that's another piece of it. Just made me realize that. So all through here,
yes,
there are pieces of this history.
Yes.
That exists.
Yes. And while these pieces have been written about, and certainly Christiana has been written about, the context,
right.
I think that there's so much more that can happen in terms of putting it all in context and rethinking the arguments, because we've been handed arguments that were developed in some instances 100 years ago. And I think what my book is doing and these other books that you were speaking about, as we've come up with a new sort of genre or at least a new category or direction, is that we can start to think about, ask new questions, ask questions that have never been asked of the data before. And when we reconfigure the way we interpret our history, we can come up with new arguments.
Yeah, and let's talk about that. It's, I mean, because I think that there's a complex thing you talk about in here between people who had been born slaves, like Erasmus Green.
Yes.
And how that's tied into the colonization societies.
Yes.
And wanting to move black folks out.
Yes.
And also, but the movement had started with runaway slaves already moving into these territories, mm-hmm. that created a world. I mean,
yes.
That talk a bit,
yes.
about that kind of weird, strange history and how that fit together.
Well, you know, escape from slavery takes many forms. And so I think I talk about this in the book, that people are, the first response to slavery throughout the diaspora is escape. So you have people escaping from the very beginning. You start to see it in 1560. But you also have later on, and Maryland is a leader in this, a colonization society where whites are thinking, let's get rid of, let's deport, essentially. You know, it's the opposite of immigration. Let's get rid of these African Americans. But at the same time, you have black nationalists who are also calling for leaving and doing it as a black nationalist statement, to go off to Haiti and to Cuba and to Africa and to go away from the United States. And so you have multiple arguments and multiple combinations for deciding how people should move through the landscape, whether we should stay or whether we should go. So you have arguments on both sides of that divide. You know, one saying we should leave because this is a nationalist statement and we should go someplace where we can be supported and really have our own agency and power. And then you have the colonists, which is very much a Maryland initiated here, that says, let's go back. Let's send you back to Liberia. You know, let's send you back to Sierra Leone. Let's get rid of you, which is basically what it is. It's
right.
A deportation plan.
Right. Mm-hmm. You might not believe in enslaving human beings, but you certainly want black folks living next to you.
I don't care where you go, but you can't be here.
Right. That was the subtext of that movement, right?
Exactly.
So, but the people you write about in here, and I think that this is another piece that's really important to talk about, which is the role of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the role of, let's talk about all the churches, the Zion Church, the role of black churches in this,
yes.
in the 19th century,
yes.
that we never hear about.
Because it was a revelation for us as we began to
It was
to
a revelation
look.
For you, right?
Yes.
For all of
us.
I never
for
heard about this before this.
When I went out west, I tell this story in the book, and I tell it to everybody who knows me. I went out west, and I got to Rocky
When you say
Fork,
west, we're talking about Indiana.
Indiana, Illinois. You know, I'm a New Yorker, so that was west.
I thought you were talking like the 18th century west.
No.
Which
the
is
New
what
York
that would be.
West.
Right.
So I was in, I started out in Rocky Fork, and Charlotte Johnson, one of my informers who insisted that I look at Rocky Fork, started telling me about Bishop Quinn and these AME churches. And I listened and I took note. But when I got to Indiana, Paul Quinn's name was on the deed of the church in Indiana. When I got back to Maryland, Paul Quinn, there's a Quinn Chapel around the corner. So already, this network of churches, when you study the AME Church is the easiest. It is not the only. And so my book focuses on the AME Church because, as I said to you, this research is arduous, time-consuming, difficult. The AME Church had a network that was easier to research and more extensive than AME Zion and the Black Baptists, which are also extensive but not to the same level of cohesion across the country. So I could look at these various churches. There was more data because they had annual meetings, they had conferences and general conferences, and they had minutes.
We were more organized than the rest in a national sense.
More organized and quite militant, I would say, although you don't get that sense from the way the black church is discussed. You know, Frederick Douglass, so many people are really maligning these black ministers. But like any other experience, we have a range of capacities and a range of people who are in the black ministry. But this is the elite class in this time period. They are the black leaders. You have to remember, and I say this in the book, this is before, big government. And this is before there's any notion of sanction or safety for African Americans. And so it is the black church that is the institutional home, along with the Freemasons and what happens later on when you start to see these other social institutions coming up, literary societies, and for example. But the black church has a very anchoring and substantial role to play that the church doesn't even begin to speak about until at least until after they come out of slavery.
Your book is chock full of these maps.
Yes.
Old ones and things that you
created. I love maps,
right?
Yes.
I can tell. What you're depicting here are where these churches were.
Yes.
Where the church was in Rocky Fork.
Yes.
And the role it played in Rocky Fork, Alton, and Brooklyn on the way and the Underground Railroad. I mean, that's because when we see Underground Railroads now, it's usually really good white folks who are hiding out black folks on their way to Canada or someplace else.
Yes.
But this paints a more complex picture.
Yes. You know, history is never as flat as it's portrayed.
Right.
Definitely, when you look at those, let me just say, it's difficult to find stories where black folks have said, I came through Rocky Fork, I came through Brooklyn.
I
can't give you that. I can only piece together this history thus far based on the land, based on the churches, based on the reason why I have that map of Indiana is because that makes my argument. Look, here are all the black communities. Look, here are all of the noted and agreed upon Underground Railroad sites. Here are all of the black churches. And look, what happens? They converge. And so it's actually my argument is in the land. It's in the geography. It's in the maps. Because I can't give you stories from each of these places, particularly each of these black communities.
Because some of what you write about here, some of these stories were oral stories,
yes,
handed down from generation to generation.
Yes, yes.
So, and that's how and things change that way as well.
Yes, yes. And I'm on a campaign to really elevate oral history and to give it a different understanding of how to use it. It has a very important role to play, particularly in black history. This is an oral culture.
And you talk about how, you know, the kind of different underground railroad stations that were there, places like Upper Alton.
Yes.
That you visited.
Yes.
And how the river played a role in that because of what they were and the community that was built up around there, made up of free blacks and even made up of some people who were former slave owners.
Yes.
Who came north.
Yes.
And went to the other side.
Yes, yes. You see, there's so many different moral and psychological underpinnings that are going on. You see former slaveholders moving their entire family, the entire group of people that they once held in slavery, moving them into northern territories and then granting emancipation, or often African Americans have to purchase their freedom. You know, this altruism is not what it appears to be. So you have to buy your freedom. You have to pay these bonds. There's money involved. But you do see the change of heart. And these people often live among the people that they formerly enslaved. So that's an aspect of these communities. And I'm not trying to say that these black communities operate in isolation. They are operating in tandem with these white communities, but previously have gone unrecognized.
So we're also talking about alliances between white and black communities that we didn't know existed before.
We knew they existed among the Quakers. We can all, you know, most anybody who's a Quaker historian who's done a lot of deep work around
right.
Quaker history, they recognize that. But just as we talked about the black church changing over time and space, mm-hmm. when you get out to the western states, I'm trying to be a little better, you know, you're looking at the Presbyterians, for example, who are also quite active. You know, you have different religious denominations taking the lead as well.
Which is one of the reasons why the Presbyterian Church was so strong among free black folks in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. I think probably for just that reason.
And you see there are lots of black Presbyterian ministers.
Right.
And when you look, you know, in the back, there's that minister's chart, which won't mean much to people who aren't, I don't want to say experts, but who aren't steeped in this subject. But I put that chart together to, again, say, look at all of these ministers that you know about, some of whom you don't even realize were ministers, and they are prominent in the Underground Railroad. So my argument is tying together. I would expect, you know, scholars to come behind me. I hope this is a pace-setting book, and I hope scholars that I've set the research agenda and that scholars will come behind me and be able to then flesh out many of the things that I've talked about.
Now, the guy I try to remember was Sides, the former slave owner who moved north and lived among free blacks, and that's why I could not remember. Let's talk about Poke Patch for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, here was a place that was, again, racially mixed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. With a lot of free black folks living there.
Yes.
And was kind of a centerpiece.
Yes.
A center of the Underground Railroad.
Yes.
Poke Patch, Ohio.
Yes. Yes. And it's one of the places. Wilbur Siebert, who was the sort of white scholar who looked at the Underground Railroad from that perspective, spoke about it and put it on the map, so to speak, gave it its legitimacy in Underground Railroad history. Because that's one of the places where you can turn. Siebert is a sort of a touchstone. But Poke Patch had its own internal black history as well, had black churches around it, and had a lot of black activities going on there as well. And so that was one of the easier places to take the black and white history and the narratives and tie them together to start to look at this overall discussion. But for Poke Patch, the most important thing, again, was centering it inside of the iron regions that I talk about and a different pathway to freedom there as well.
So it's a really important piece to talk about, though, for a moment, is when you write a little bit about this in the book, is the power of archaeology. And talk about how that played into this. I mean, the literal work of an archaeologist in doing this.
Well, you know, the work of an archaeologist is, first of all, as I said before, is to locate and to put things in context. But then when we start to dig, we know the size of the spaces. We know spatial relationships. We can tell what people have used. We found slates, you know, example of literacy and an acquisition of literacy. And these are humble sites. We're not going to find huge amounts of artifacts, but we find enough to really look at the location, the space, where it sits, where the church sits in relationship to other spaces. So it's much more informative when you're looking over a region or a section so you can put things into context.
You write in here that archaeology will help identify new networks, routes, and previously unidentified participants. In doing so, archaeological investigations should receive equal consideration in tandem with oral history, mapping, and historical documentation as necessary components within the expanded reclamation process. Archaeology furthers the ability to identify and map black settlements and define spatial relationships between families and institutions.
Absolutely.
Talk about that for just a moment.
Well, again, because archaeology has not been included, and we often have buildings that are torn down because we can't prove that they were Underground Railroad sites, or that I think about what happened up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, when archaeologists started to look. This is in a different context. Around Thaddeus Stevens, they began to find some anomalies, what we call it in archaeology, where things just don't quite make sense. So that we can look at census data, because archaeologists don't just dig. We have to do a lot of historical research. So if we set out to excavate an area that we think was a black community and may more than likely have associations with the Underground Railroad, we're going to be looking at census data. We're going to have to understand who lived there. We're going to have to understand what the layout of the land was. We're going to have to understand who came and went. That will all be as part of our research before we ever start to dig. We don't just go out and find a place and start digging. We have a huge amount of research agenda before us and with us, and it guides us as we dig.
So tell me, Dr. Cheryl Jennifer LaRoche, how you think this book fits into the pantheon of the work, and what is the work to come?
It's a good question. This book ties together what had been discrete narratives around, let's say, the Black church, but not the Black community. The Black community, but not the Underground Railroad. So I took all of these topics and pulled them together. I would think, I would hope, I would pray that in the future, anyone looking at an archaeological site or Underground Railroad site would start to think to themselves, based on what Dr. LaRoche has said, let me look here. Let me see what's the nearest clustering, not communities, because when we think about Black communities, we look at clusterings in the census data. And as soon as I start to see color, whatever it is that I see, I know I'm coming upon a concentration of African Americans in the landscape. So when we start to look at that census data, when we start to go back to the history and understand that, oh, look, there had been a church here in 1837, peace, put that in, mm-hmm. and then start to look at what's going on in the larger Underground Railroad narrative and put these things together, I'm thinking of my book as a roadmap, that this book is a map that will help us think through something that has been a mystery for, 250 years. We have not been able to figure out exactly how this thing worked.
The whole Underground Railroad.
The whole Underground Railroad.
And this is a piece of the puzzle.
And this is one more piece of the puzzle.
And let me just say, I think this is a very important piece of the puzzle.
It's a big chunk. You know, when you do puzzles and you finally get to something and it just...
This is, and you literally have done the map.
Yes.
In here. So yes. I think this is an amazing book. We were talking to Dr. Cheryl Jennifer LaRoche, L-A-R-O-C-H-E. And Dr. LaRoche will be giving a lecture on her book, Free Black Communities and the Underground Railroad, The Geography of Resistance, at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture this Saturday, February the 8th at 1 p.m. I don't want to miss it. She's an amazing woman. She's as good as she'll be better there than she is here even. And mm-hmm. she'll give a great lecture. You can register by calling 443-263-1816, or you can email resourcecenter@maamc.org. The snow date is February the 15th, in case something goes wrong.
And we're selling books, too.
It was selling books as well, and it'll all be on our website as well, steinershow.org. And Dr. Cheryl LaRoche, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was a delight.
On Our Way Out, one of my favorite songs of all time, The Redemption Song, Bob Marley, left us much too soon. Left us with much. Born on this day in 1945. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Alex Boston and Matt Malice. You can hear the show again on podcasts, all of our past shows, and find out information about our guests and what they talked about in this program and the work they do by visiting us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts now on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. This generation triumphantly, won't you help to sing?